Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more. Hi, welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. We're coming to you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It is Wednesday, October 14th. This is the 82nd episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talents in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is a chef by trade turned festival producer. I will be introducing him in a moment. First, as I do in every show, I will start out with my PR tip. Then later, we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. Today's tip is to stay humble. Be modest about your career and personal achievements. Nobody likes a bragger or know-it-all, right? Smart people will recognize your success without having to spell it out for them. True leaders are confident, respected, and humble. So keep that in mind the next time you want to boast. Humility is the better policy. That's my tip today. Now, I am thrilled to have my behind-the-scenes guest here. It is Devin Padgett. He is the owner of Dev Inc., a company of festival engineers based in Basalt, Colorado. Devin is the producer of special projects for Food & Wine magazine, including The Classic in Aspen, as well as managing director of Sobe Wine and Food Festivals. And he's in town for NYC Food & Wine Festival. So, welcome, Devin.
Sure am. Hi, Sherry. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming out here. Get you away from maybe some of the action that you're setting up and working on with the NYC Wine and Food Festival.
We are well underway, been hot at it for the last couple of three or four days, and we're getting ready to go, popping it live tomorrow. We're very excited. Great program in store for everybody this year.
Yeah, well, we'll talk a little more about the festival, the specifics, but I like to start out with people's background because right. I really don't know how you went from being a chef to being a festival engineer.
Still trying to figure that out myself.
So, give me a little of the background. Like, growing up, did you want to be a chef? Did you know you wanted to get...
Not at all. I mean, listen, chef by trade. And, you know, I think a lot of this is timing and good luck and good fortune. And of course, I'm going to age myself here too, because I've been doing this a long time. But when I started cooking, I'll never forget telling my parents, I wanted to cook. It just kind of happened organically. No real thought put into it as a young man. But when I told my parents I wanted to be a chef or a cook, I mean, they cried. It was not a cool thing. You know, this was back in the 80s, and it was not, chefs were not rock stars yet. This was not, it was work of labor, not necessarily work of love, at least where I came from. So, it wasn't cool yet.
Well, in 1997, after I graduated college, I was living in Chicago, and I decided I wanted to go to cooking school and be a chef.
Right.
My parents did not think it was as cool as maybe they would think it was now. I don't know, but both of us ended up not doing that. But you did. Well, tell me,
for a long time, and I love cooking. I loved the life and got everything out of it that I wanted to. It all kind of just happened, like I said, organically. I mean, there was no plan put into place. Again, cooking in the 80s, I did the classic style apprenticeship. I worked for a little over 2 years for a great German chef named Roland Ott, who nobody knows who that is, but it was a very classic European, lived on property apprenticeship in New Jersey at the Shore. It was really cool at the Flanders was the name of the place. I think it's still called the Flanders. It's been there for many, many years. But after that very classically trained apprenticeship, I This is, you know, this is the mid 80s. This is like in 1984, I guess, 1985. Only wanted to come to the Waldorf Astoria in New York or the Ritz-Carlton in Boston. Those were my two picks. Like, again, this whole world hadn't blown up yet.
You
know, people weren't obsessed with food and drink and eating and the lifestyle and everything that we, you know, is kind of part of our culture now. And that's really what's changed in 25 years, right, or 30 years. But anyway, got a job at the Waldorf Astoria in New York, moved to New York, didn't know anybody.
Where are you originally from?
Military brat, all over.
Okay.
Yeah, like born in Spain and lived in lots of places and lots of states. And I guess if I had to call a home from a childhood perspective, I'd went to high school all 4 years in Virginia.
Okay.
So my family kind of settled in Virginia. So that's where that, maybe a little bit of that Southern comes from. But
I'm hearing it now. It's coming out.
Yeah.
A little twang.
Yeah, a little bit. So, yeah, so New York and the Waldorf Astoria was a great experience. I was actually telling a story on the way over here about my days at the Waldorf, trying to remember all of this. And there's a lot forgotten, for sure. It's from there, did some stages in Europe, in Belgium, in Copenhagen, Denmark. And before Copenhagen was cool, you know, René Redzepi, you hear me?
No, before NOMA.
Yeah, before NOMA. And then kind of traveled all over. And you know, cooked, and I think I was a really good cook. I mean, you know, I heard your tip at the beginning of the show, but I'll say I really enjoyed cooking, and cooking was really starting to come into its own. And, you know, the way I remember it, you know, from a buzz perspective, you know, names, I'll never forget, for instance, I must have been a senior in high school, seeing Wolfgang Puck on The Tonight Show. It was a chef on The Tonight Show. Now, we could fact check that and find the year. I don't know. I'm going to say 83, 84, 82, somewhere back in there. And it was like the coolest thing. I was cooking already, in high, you know, as a high school job. This is before I did my apprenticeship and all that. But, wow, there's a chef on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, you know. And so here we go. And that sort of, you know, was the run-up or the beginning of, you know, everything that happened, you know. And here we are all these years later with, you know, full-blown rock stars and you know all the people we work with and you and I get to work with and you know throughout the year. But it wasn't like that then, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
No, it wasn't. You know. And there weren't all these culinary festivals. I mean, before the show we were talking about there are so many practically in every city, and I am trying to mix it up and go to different ones, but there's the standard ones that you know, you don't want to miss Aspen, or you don't want to miss NYC or South Beach, or,
right.
you know, there's,
right.
but to see other cities and go there. But this is a new concept too, these culinary festivals.
Well, again, yeah, I don't know if it was right place, right time, or, you know, culture shift or all of the above, but, you know, as I was cooking along, I think one thing led to another, and I ended up in Texas, in San Antonio, Texas, and I was chef de cuisine for a man named Bruce Auden, who's still in San Antonio, and he was an original first-year Best New Chef for Food & Wine magazine.
Oh, okay.
And Food & Wine had
amazing.
Been... Yeah, Food & Wine, this was 1988, Food & Wine had been doing this little thing in Aspen, Colorado called the Food & Wine Classic, and actually it was called the Aspen Snowmass Wine Class. There's been through many name changes, especially in the early days. But at that point, it was 3 or 4 years old, and it within the industry, within the you know the cook's world, if you made it to Aspen, if you got invited to Aspen, if you knew anybody that was going to Aspen, like it was a really cool thing. And so everybody always wanted to go to Aspen. This is again, this is late 80s. So Bruce was honored as a Best New Chef, the first class, along with Thomas Keller, and I believe Daniel Ballou was in that first class. I'd have to look, but an amazing roster.
Yeah.
So I went to Aspen with Bruce and to help support him for, you know, Best New Chefs. And here we are in this beautiful, gorgeous mountain town. It was immediate love. I think I said earlier, I've moved around and lived in a lot of places, mm-hmm. but I knew this was it. Like seriously, I was all of 25 years old and like had landed home. Like it was, I can remember how it smelled and how it felt and, you know, all those things. And we're at this classic, this big festival. And so, yes, to answer your question, like that, and that was the festival. That was the Food & Wine Festival, the Food & Wine Classic in Aspen, which is what we call it now and have for the last 20 years. Was really the original. There really is. You can trace it all back. It's like the Kevin Bacon thing where everybody's uh-huh. related to him, you know, that one degree of separation or whatever. But within the Food & Wine Festival world, I think that there is something from Aspen that's in all of them now.
Yeah, well, I went 5 years in a row, and now I haven't been for three, and I'm due to go back because miss it. And there's just something, about that festival, the ambiance, the way it's organized and run, the industry people that attend, that participate. I still think it's the best, and I think the other festivals have their character and take bits and pieces, I think, from learning from what has happened at the Classic. And I don't know, I can see how you fell in love with it. So you fell in love with it. So then you decided to move there and help out.
Well, I mean, kind of. What was going on that first year I was there? The ski company was building the Little Nell Hotel. It was under construction.
Okay.
So there was lots of talent in town that was interviewing to be the chef at the Little Nell, which was opening in, I believe, December of 1989. And again, long story, but one of my friends back in Texas, from Dallas, Richard Chamberlain, who was at San Simeon in Dallas, was in Aspen, as was, it seemed to me, the whole culinary world. He interviewed for that position, and over the course of the summer, going back to Texas, one thing led to another. He called me. He said, I'm headed out to Aspen to be the new executive chef at Little Nell. Do you want to come along? And I wasn't necessarily looking for a job, but it was right time, right place, right phone call, the right guy. I was ready to leave the Fairmont where I was with Bruce. Bruce actually had just left. So it's just good timing. And I was like, absolutely. I jumped right on board and out to Aspen we went. We opened up in the fall or December of 1989, I believe. And that was during the time, during that winter, Food and Wine was planning for the Classic, which must have been, the sixth or seventh Classic coming up in June, right? Not nearly the serious operation or the serious, festival that it is, that it has become. But the team came out in the spring, I remember this, and Richard took off for a week or two. Again, serendipity, good timing, whatever you want to call it. He was gone, so I got to entertain the Food and Wine folks, breakfast, lunch, and dinner for however many days they were there, and one thing led to another, and yeah, I'll help you out. I'd love to help. It was great. I was out here last year supporting Bruce, and so I volunteered the first year or two of the Classic.
Okay.
And helped them out, helped liaison with all the chefs, because I still had a job. I was the executive sous chef at the Little Nell. So I
did not know that.
Yeah, so I actually had my real job, and but when Food and Wine and the Classic came around, I was there to support, and we had a lot of chefs in house and helping them with all their ingredients and mise en place and all the prep for the Classic and all that, and that's kind of started from that level.
So you're volunteering, and you're still full time as a chef, and then every year you would start volunteering with them. When did you make the transition into, I'm not going to be cooking anymore?
That actually just kind of happened. I want to say I was at the Nell. I went to Santa Fe for a year, opened a restaurant there called Geronimo, which is still operating. Came back to Aspen because Aspen's that place, or at least for me, I tried to leave, but I'm not going anywhere now. Aspen's home. Even during sort of that moving around, maintain my contact with the Classic. And yes, I worked every year since then. This is my 28th coming up, I believe. The next year, I want to say, they hired me, in a small role to help out and assist. And it really just chipped away up the stairs. It was a small working role to help them organize and plan for, I'm making it up, but maybe it was a month out. Whereas now these things are on 18, 24 month cycles. I mean, it was literally like, hey, it's March, we're doing the Classic in June, you want to help us out? And we got, 2 months to get it together. It was like that back then. Not so much anymore. But I stayed in Aspen, or went back to Aspen, and cooked, opened up a couple of places there. I was the chef at Mezzaluna. I was the chef at the Maroon Creek Club, that new development when it was new. In about 1997, 98 was when it became very clear that this was something I could do. And, that along with lifestyle, getting married, lots of changes, now I'm maturing into a, a well-rounded 33-year-old. So, or 34-year-old. So, it became apparent that this was actually something viable. And again, not from any planning, not from any blueprint, not from anybody saying, here's what you do. It was just like, wow, I can actually work with Food and Wine and, you know, help produce the classic, and the classic became more, and here we are.
So that's the story.
Yeah.
Excellent. We're going to take a little break and come back and hear more about now what you do as the festival engineer of food and wine festivals. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Devin Padgett, the owner of Dev Inc., a company of festival engineers. He's the man behind NYC and South Beach Wine and Food Festivals and the Food and Wine Classic in Aspen, which we're just talking about how he got started with that. So, Devin, as a festival engineer, like, what does that mean? Like, how do you go about producing these events?
Well, you know, the term festival engineer is something we came up with, I don't know if we were kidding or not, maybe 7 or 8 years ago. Like, how do we kind of define our great team, this very sort of niche that we have, like, found ourselves in, you know, helping to produce these festivals? And let me just say that, you know, the real kind of vision and behind these festivals is not me. I mean, Food and Wine is behind the Classic in Aspen. The one and only, the great Lee Schrager, is the visionary behind the South Beach Wine and Food Festival in New York City. And, you know, it's another fortunate case that I've gotten to work with really great people in my career and in my life. And Lee would be one, Christina Gertovich from Food and Wine Magazine, and Dana, of course, and that whole team over there. Like, you know, we're family. But how do we become festival engineers? It's from the culinary background. I think there's a lot of similarity there. You know, working in kitchens all those years, it translated really well. It's all about the detail. It's all about timing. It's all about those subtle nuances. You know, from first impression at a live large format event all the way to the exit is very much like, you know, going to dinner and having a great meal and having, you know, multiple courses, you know, presented to you and in the right way, in the right style, with great flavor. You know, I mean, you can sort of draw the analogy, and I don't know, maybe I'm, you know, overanalyzing, but there's a lot of similarity there, the detail. So when I kind of transitioned out of live cooking or cooking for a living, which again was back, you know, late 90s, and decided that I could figure out how to be a festival producer. I took a lot of what I had learned all the way up to that, you know, to that point, and from the kitchen and from all my years in the kitchens, and really applied it to production.
So perhaps it's like mise en place, like you have to get everything,
mise en place, everything in its place. Exactly. It's all about the details and organizing and, you know, contacting the right people and having the right schedules and having them on a timeline and having yourself on a timeline and, you know, having, you know, creating a plan, a run of show, we call it, to sort of roll out whatever the production is. And like, really, I mean, that's not unlike, you know, opening a kitchen, you know, or opening a restaurant on a daily basis. Even you just got to have everything in its right place. And so being highly detailed, I think, and organized, which is were skills I learned along the way, and how to do all that, I think it applied directly to, you know, picking up, you know, with an event, with a live event, small, large, medium, whatever. I mean, obviously you construct it. I mean, there's a vision, there's a creative spark, you know, and then the process is really just sort of writing it all down and like figuring out, you know, the content and then the marketing and then, you know, how it's all going to fit together all the way down to the production and logistics. Again, all very similar to, you know, lots of different businesses out there, I'm sure, but kitchen work, it applied well. So, you know, my experience with the classic, the other, I think, bonus there was, again, very young kind of, I don't know if it's an industry, but it was, you know, it had been around 6, 7, 8 years when I got involved, 6 actually. And there was no manual, right? There was no reference book to go and say, oh, whoops, this is not good. How do we fix it? You know, you have to kind of make your way through. And so we got to sort of make lots of mistakes, you know, and, trial and error, and fix things and, you know, try to be smart and creative. And that kind of just, you know, applied to the classic then. And then as the other festivals started to unroll, or roll out, Lee called me in 2001, 2002, I guess, and he had this great idea that he wanted to do. What he wanted to do was the best food and wine festival east of the Mississippi is what he always said. He didn't want to, you know, it wasn't a competitive thing. Aspen was Aspen, but that was his goal and his vision. And I know you know the whole story behind the South Beach Wine and Food Festival. It's a great one as well. But I've been there almost from the beginning. With Lee. And, you know, that was the next big one.
Right.
Right. And so we just picked up, you know, again, lots of years of learning at Aspen. I also did a lot of work. I've done a lot of work with sports, with ESPN, the X Games. I learned a lot from those guys. I would be remiss not to point them out as well. I mean, from a production standpoint, a logistics standpoint, which is so, you know, kind of out of the kitchen, but from that side of it, X Games and ESPN, ABC Sports, you know, a lot of work with them in my early years, ski racing, you know, and producing events. Right. Again, it's just about all the spokes in the wheel, getting everybody in the right place at the right time, executing, and, you know, there you go. So we just applied it.
See, you are humble. Because, it's true, though. When I said the man behind, I was thinking, like, you're the perfect, for my show, being a behind-the-scenes guy, like
totally this, behind the scenes.
This to me, like the man behind the scenes of these festivals, because you're right, Lee Schrager and all those people that created these festivals. And Lee came on my show last year with Adina for his book, and
right.
I'm a huge fan. So behind the scenes. So I'm thinking. So now there's a manual that says rent big tent.
Could be. I mean, that'd be a good place to start. Sure.
Make sure it will hold up on sand or on a pier.
Right.
Or, I mean, you have a lot of, there's a lot of challenges with these events because they're massive.
They're massive and they're large. And it's fun. It's learning along the way. And, you know, I also like to point out that, yes, working with great people, I think, you know, obviously, you know, I always love working with people that, know their stuff, that are better than me, that I can learn from. Like that's key, right? And just daily life, you know, if you can get up and learn something new every day, like that's the best day. But these festivals themselves, these productions that we're talking about, they were definitely built on the back of people that, you know, sort of led the way from a production standpoint and sort of laid it out there. And that's kind of where I came in. Like,
right.
You know, the reach out was, hey, can you help me with this? Can you come in and help me fix this, build this, you know, work this out? And that's, you know, it's great to look back on that and say, yeah, you know what? From the very beginning, you know, I helped sort of provide the platform upon which this great event was built. So that's where it all started.
So you're out here now for NYC Food and Wine Festival, right. And you're taking the time to come out here to Bushwick. What are you going back to today? Like, where are you at now? The festival kicks off tomorrow.
Yeah, Claudia and I were talking about this driving over. Like the real fun part, well, of all of them, but of New York, it's a composite. We literally get to, and we produce the culinary demos for the massive New York City Wine and Food Festival, which is happening this weekend. And there's 142 events, I think.
That's it.
What? You know, they're all over the city.
At least 150.
Yeah, exactly. We're producing 24 live culinary demo segments. You know, with everybody from Giada to Rachel to Patti LaBelle to we got a crazy, crazy schedule. But we get to start at the very beginning and not only sort of deal with the talent from the ground all the way up through their content, what they're doing, but I get to like put the whole team together. We start literally, like last night at this time, Sherry, I had chalk in my hand. I was chalking out the outlines of where the stage sets are going or where the front of house is going for the camera positions, and then talking audio this morning, you know, and all of that sort of technical detail. That's going to roll all the way into this weekend where I literally have to take a shower and dress up and try to look as nice as I can. I actually host the stages. So I actually bring the talent out. So it's a full role for us. It's setting up, and we get a blank canvas, really. You know, Lee and I will talk and the team will talk about, you know, who makes sense. And, you know, we're lucky to have, you know, 40 or 50 possible talent to do these demos. So we cull it down and work with the Food Network. And, you know, here's our 24 segments for Saturday and Sunday. That starts back in April. So this has been going on since late March, of getting the scheduling together. That's the first part of it. And not to bore you with all this detail, but
no, you know, that's what I want
to
hear.
Right. Then we get to all the way up to site and have a great team of people. Mike Blomquist, you know, the festival engineers, the Dev Inc. Festival engineers are a team of people. I don't know. We have
how many?
A little over 50, I think.
Wow. Freelancers
that come in and work projects. I think we've got 22 or 23 on site for this year's New York City. And that's culinary, it's production, it's operations. It runs the whole gamut. I've got a project manager. His name is Mike Blomquist. Way to go, Mike. Great job. he's been working really hard for the last 6 months on organizing all the details that we're talking about. So from taking the venue, you know, outlining the actual physical footprints, hiring all the vendors, working with the unions, making sure the staff is there, doing all the grocery shopping, you know, collecting all the content, all the way through working with, you know, our friends at William Morris and the agents to make sure that the talent is there on time. And, you know, there's lots of other people that are working. I mean, there are literally 150, 200 people, core people working the overall event, the overall festival. But as far as the culinary demos, we're fairly self-contained. We work with seven or eight other key people on the festival team. But, you know, again, like I said, I'll take the microphone on Saturday and literally bring, you know, Rachel and Jada and Marcus and everybody out on stage, and they'll do their thing, and, you know, they'll shine on stage, hopefully, and have a great time. And we'll wrap it up on Sunday late and start on next year.
Well, I've seen you in action. You do a great job. You'll clean up well and do a great, great host. Let me ask you the question I had from last week. I had on Chris Cannon. He's the owner of Jockey Hollow Bar and Kitchen in Morristown, New Jersey, which, by the way, Esquire magazine had their Best Restaurants of America come out today, and Jockey Hollow Bar and Kitchen was on that list. So congratulations, Chris. Now, his question is, how do you deal with all the egos?
Wow. Congrats, Chris, on that. I know Chris. What egos? There's no egos. All egos are checked at the door. Mm. I used to tell, I've told the story before, call it 5 years ago. We actually had some talent on some shows, and I'm not going to give you any specifics here, that actually started giving us hospitality and technical writers for their appearances. This is where chefs have gotten to. Again, not naming any names, right? But, you know, their handlers and their PR people or their agents literally would have writers written up. You know, not quite the, you know, the Van Halen or the Rolling Stones writer yet, but, you know, some very, very interesting requests and needs. Listen, from a chef standpoint, here's part, I think, of the secret, maybe not secret, this is part of the formula of our success at Dev Inc. and Festival Engineers. I know all these guys. I know a lot of them. I've worked with a lot of these guys that have been around now, being very successful chefs, and very, really fortunately so. Like, and we're friends. We may have worked together way back in the past, or in the not too recent, you know, or not too long ago, whether it be at a festival or otherwise. And, you know, I think our work really is just like, it's like life. You know, it all comes down to the relationships. We have really good relationships with most of these people. They're our friends. We're there trying to produce them and make them shine and have the best, most seamless, most positive experience that they can have. So we're all on board. We're all on this. They're all on the same page. And I'm not going to tell you we don't ever come up against an ego or a tough situation, but you know, we work our way through it. I'm sitting here trying to think of a good example or something that would be fun to tell your audience. But you know, I mean, the egos I think are pretty normal, sort of along the, you know, within the scope of the talent and the people that we're talking about. I mean, it's right. There's nothing crazy.
All right. Well,
sorry to disappoint you, Chris. I mean,
I think you answered that well. I think he'll be satisfied.
Okay.
Okay, so we're going to take another break here. We're going to come back and do my speed round game and talk some industry news. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, this is Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past. And you know, I remember my very first show, December 2009. Ooh, it was a cold winter. And my first guest was William Grimes from the New York Times. Now, the one specific I had to tell him was wear a hat, gloves, and a warm coat, because our studio had no heat. We had no heat in the winter. We had no air conditioning in the summertime. It was rough going, but we were a startup, and we had a good show, regardless of the fact that we could see our breath. So today, we still have hurdles to climb over, and the only way we can get there is with your help. So if you would please consider being a member and press that little beating heart button in the upper right-hand corner to donate. It's going to help us have heat and electricity and air conditioning and really good sound with really great guests. Thanks for listening.
Okay, we are back. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest is Devin Padgett. And it is time for my speed round game. So, Devin, is, I'm going to name two or more things, and you just pick your preference.
Okay.
Here we go. Very easy. No, there's no right or wrong.
All right.
Eat in or eat out?
Out.
Wine, beer, cocktail, or mocktail?
Mock.
Tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte.
Small plates or large plates?
Small.
Communal table or chef's counter?
Communal.
Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Well, with the news that broke today, I'm going to say all-inclusive charge.
Yeah, I have to go back and listen to my episodes because the answers started changing. I've been asking this for over a year and a half.
I'm taking advantage of current events.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. A few more in the game, and then we'll talk about the news. Okay, how about putting up a tent on grass, the beach, or a pier?
Grass.
Burger Bash or Meatopia?
Oof, Meatopia.
Cheese plate or dessert?
Dessert for me.
Manhattan, Brooklyn, Aspen, or Basalt?
Oh, my goodness. That's not fair. Basalt.
How far is Basalt from Aspen?
20 minutes.
Okay.
That's, 14 miles down the road? Yeah.
Got it.
It's the next town down.
Great. You did well at that game.
Thanks.
Okay, so the big news that broke this morning, breaking news, I think it's breaking down Twitter. I think Danny Meyer is trending.
I think so.
So the first I saw it was on Eater that Ryan Sutton wrote about how Danny Meyer is eliminating tipping at his restaurants. So this is huge news. And people, you know, the tipping thing has been talked about a lot this year. And as I said, the opinions are kind of changing on it. But he's decided he's eliminating tipping at all of his restaurants. There's 13 total. He's starting with the Modern at MoMA, which he'll start next month. And he says dish prices will increase a little, but he feels it's time. And I then got an email, you know, from Union Square Hospitality Group that he wrote to people on his email list. And one of the lines in it I liked, you know, he says, "We believe hospitality is a team sport." So I think it's saying it's time to kind of, you know, keep the wage across the board fair.
Listen, it's big news. If anybody can do this and lead the way, it's certainly Danny Meyer and his amazing group at Union Square Hospitality. I not even a joke. I've told him for many years. He's been coming to the Classic for as long as I have, and is a great friend of Food and Wine and a great friend of ours. I've always told him when I grow up, I want to be Danny Meyer. And I think probably a lot of us have.
Yeah,
He's just an amazing human being. What he's doing now, I know that's a long time coming. This was not something that happened overnight.
Right.
They've been talking about it and thinking, you know, it's been a big debate and a big topic of conversation for many years in our world. And what I like best about it, if it works, and I know that it's going to work, like it may take time. It's going to be a re-education. It's going to be a reculturalization, actually, in the, I think, dining experience, really. But what I like most about it, and this is probably being selfish, putting my cook's hat back on, is, you know, one of the premises, one of the ideas here is to get that living wage, get that wage up for the back of the house, the guy or the girl who's back there, you know, really working hard, cooking, the cooks, you know, the kitchen, the people working in the kitchen. Like, I mean, it's not that it's slanted any one way, but like to get that wage up, you know. It's such a craft, and you have to have such passion to want to be a great cook and a great, you know, to be a chef. And there's just not a lot of, you know, economic support in our world to do that, you know, to kind of live at such a low scale and work so hard. I think this and the all in and Danny's idea here and Union Square Hospitality's ideal here, I think that's a big part of it. And I love that part.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, there's been a shortage of line cooks, too, that people have been talking about for, you know, beyond this year. And I think, you know, the wage does have a part in that.
Has a big part of that. I have, again, lots of friends, obviously, in the industry. And, like, that's been the biggest stress for many years now. Yes, it's been talked about a lot in the last year or two.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, since the crash and, you know, everything's recovered. But the kitchen is the line out there in our small world. But, yeah, it's due. And if this can help solve some of that and make things a little more equitable, a little more fair, and give people a little better quality of life, you know, from an economic standpoint, I'm all for it.
Yeah, and I've always admired Danny. I mean, I sometimes I think to myself, well, what would Danny do,
right,
you know, when I'm making a decision? Because he is so smart, and I think, and so nice. And I definitely think this is huge news, because it's just, they're a major restaurant group that influences a lot of people. So
big influencers. And I think that us as consumers, if I can just say this, I think if we can help with this whole initiative and with this whole goal here, and really sort of take a step back, because yes, there's going to be price increases. This money's got to come from somewhere. It's got to be paid for, right? And he's very transparent, and they're very open about that. And they give the whole, you know, we'll be reading all the press and, you know, all the details behind it here over the next few days, if you haven't already. But we as consumers have to realize, hey, I would have put 25% or 30% on that anyway. You know, I don't know if prices are going to go up 10% or 15% or 20%. I know they're all kind of all over the place right now, but
there was something that said dish prices might increase as much as 30% to 35%. But basically he's saying, as a consumer, I don't think it affects us as much as it will affect, as you said, the back of the house and their wage. Like,
right,
that's where it's going to make more of a difference. Like, as consumers, we're not going to be leaving a tip. We'll be paying more for prices. And he said he's going to call it hospitality included, which
love
is
that.
So,
of course.
So Danny Meyer.
Right. So Danny. And I think it makes total sense. I'm all for it.
Yeah. Well, it's exciting. So I'm for it too. I'm, you know, it will be, I'm sure we're going to be hearing more about this. So.
Very controversial. You're going to have lots of shows about this, Sherry, I'm sure. I think, you know, this is something that's not going to be quick. It's not going to happen overnight. And we may all still be talking about this, you know, a few years from now, but you know, we'll see. Every good revolution is a slow revolution, they say. So we'll see where that comes from.
We will. Okay. So that's all we have time for with industry news. So we're going to take one more break, come back, do my solo dining experience. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. It's time for my solo dining experience, which this week is brought to you by our friends at One House Hospitality Headhunters. Check them out on Facebook and on Twitter at @one_house and at Instagram at @onehouse, and that's spelled O-N-E-H-A-U-S. So here's the rundown of my solo dinner at Al Forno. Location, 577 South Water Street in Providence, Rhode Island. The concept, upscale neighborhood restaurant known for its Italian fare and as the birthplace of grilled pizza. The chef and owners, George Germone and Johan Killeen. Why did I go? Because this place is legendary. My experience. A couple weekends ago, I drove to Providence before venturing to Newport for the Newport Mansions Wine and Food Festival, specifically to go to this restaurant. I arrived a little before 5 when it opened and was seated at a nice two-top by the windows where I could see the sun setting. What did I get? Well, I had the pizza, of course. I went with a margarita, and I also got an apple crisp tart for 2 because there were no tarts for 1, and hey, I'm worth it. My take, the grilled pizza lived up to the hype. It was shaped like a lopsided rectangle and served with a sharp knife to cut as you please. It was delicious. And my tart was beyond expectations. It was heavenly. Dessert orders are taken at the beginning of the meal as they are made fresh to order, and I could taste the difference. It was so, so good. I didn't finish either dish, and I took a goodie bag of leftovers to go. The scene, Rhode Island locals. Perfect for those who appreciate fine yet simple cooking. Interesting tidbit, Al Forno opened in January 1980 and has been serving the neighborhood since. It's basically an institution. Personal fun fact, because I'm crazy when it comes to restaurants, I took advantage of my short time in Providence and had a second dinner at Birch, another recommended restaurant. Yes, as I said, crazy. The cost, $41, not including tax and gratuity. Would I go back? Absolutely. I would love to try more of Al Forno's menu. Their website is alforno.com. So that is my solo dining experience. Have you ever been there, Devin?
I have not. On the list forever.
That was like me too. It's worth checking out.
Really? Yeah. It's still on the list.
All right. Scratch that one off my list, right. But I would like to
Good
go
for
back.
You. Yeah.
Okay. So it's time for the final question. So next week I'm having on Chris Mialy and Chef Elan Hall. They are of Blue Cut Aprons, American made aprons and chef coats handcrafted in Los Angeles, utilizing the finest materials. So, Devin, can you ask a question for Chris and Elan?
Worn lots of chef coats in my life. I was just sitting here thinking about the aprons, too.
They've become trendy,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, well, I guess the question is, chef's coat, uniform or statement? I don't know. People wear chef coats now that aren't cooking. Like, is that the goal? Is the goal to get everybody in a chef's coat, ultimately, whether they're cooking or not? I don't know.
I don't know. Was that the question?
Maybe the question is a chef coat still a uniform?
Okay.
I mean, you know, for all my career, it was a uniform. What is it now? Is it still a uniform? I'm curious. We see lots of people working in chef's whites and cook shirts and
well,
you know.
That's what I'm thinking with your demos. Are most of these chefs doing demos just wearing street clothes?
Okay, so this is exactly where the question's coming from.
That's what I'm thinking.
We're coming all the way around the circle here. The chefs, the talent that's on stage, typically, no, they're not in a chef's coat. Maybe an apron, but the people working the show, including all the Dev Inc. Festival engineers, Claudia's shaking her head now because she has them all made, they work the uniform behind the scenes for all the culinary team and even the operations team are cook shirts and some chef coats. How crazy is that? You know, it's a cool thing to wear.
It is.
I mean, I'm sure if Elan and Chris can get everybody wearing chef coats, then they've done it, right?
Yeah, and they have very cool aprons too. The aprons have become, I've just noticed that you go places and you see the chefs, bright colors, interesting, nice, you know, beyond what was happening in 1980.
Oh, my God. You remind me of all the, remember the big pants? What were they called with all
bread pants, chili pants, and tomato pants.
I had them all. I'm not ashamed to say that. Had every single pair.
That's how it began.
Yes, it all began there. It's, you know, trying to make it a little more fashionable and fun. Anyway, Elan, send me an apron or a chef's coat and let you know how it looks.
I will remind him of that. Excellent. Well, that's the show.
Thank
Sherry,
you so
thank
you
much.
For having me. This was great. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, thank you for coming out here. It's great to get to see you, and I'm looking forward to the festival this weekend.
We'll see you around all weekend, I hope.
Yeah, I will be attending, representing Heritage Radio. It will be
Absolutely.
Fun.
Absolutely.
So my guest today has been Devin Padgett. He's the owner of Dev Inc., a company of festival engineers behind Food & Wine magazines The Classic in Aspen and South Beach and New York City Wine & Food Festivals. His website is devinc.com. On Twitter, he's Devin Padgett. On Twitter and Instagram, I'm Sherry Bayer, Bayer PR, All Industry, and my Facebook page is All in the Industry, and my website's bayerpublicrelations.com. Many thanks to my engineer today, Liz Smith. Today's breakout music was provided by The Landing, and the theme song to my show is by the California Honey Drops. Thank you to our sponsor, International Culinary Center, and thank you, listener, for tuning in. If you like what you heard, tell your friends to subscribe to the show on iTunes and feel free to touch base with us at heritageradionetwork.org. Next up, we have a short clip of this from The Speakeasy, another great show right here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. I'll be back next Wednesday at 4 with another live show. I hope you'll tune in then. Thanks, Devin, and thanks for being part of All in the Industry.
Thanks
Bye.
For having me.
Well, first of all, fall is my favorite season
for
cocktails. It's just, like you said, you know, it's during harvest season. You've got all this beautiful, beautiful produce and different, like, just, like, everything. Everything's happening during, like, the end of the summer and early fall.
On episode 137 of The Speakeasy, master bartender Aaron Polsky talks to host Damon Bolte on why fall is such a perfect time to make great cocktails.
There are just new ingredients that are available to us in general. You know, and that's great. Like, the accessibility and availability of spices and good quality produce on a wholesale level is awesome. And also the technology to make them work fast. So everybody, well, not everybody, but you and I know the Dave Arnold pioneered rapid infusion technique with an EC container. And, of course, you can do that with a cryovac or, as I recently discovered, a food saver with a handy food saver Tupperware canister attachment. You can make things work fast. So you can experiment quickly. You can weigh things in grams. You can time how long it takes, how long you're putting suction on it, and you can get really good bitters, good infusions, and that's great in, you know, especially for the fall, because you think of fall, you think of, I mean, all jokes aside, you do think of pumpkin spice. You think of pumpkin pie, and you think of all those warm spices and squash and all that.
Apples, pears.
Apples, pears, pumpkin spice.
Yeah.
I think that six years ago, it would have been difficult to find different types of cinnamon, and now you can easily get them.
Whether you know what a rapid infusion machine is, or you're a bartending novice, be sure to listen to The Speakeasy, available on Heritage Radio Network and iTunes.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.